Hi, this is David Wilner.
I'm Barney Levy Sullivan.
You're listening to an original podcast, and today we're here in the studio in Efrat, and we're going to be talking about the period of Sefirat HaOmer. Counting of the Omer. Barnea, what's the Omer?
The Omer is a barley offering that was brought on the second day of Passover. And from that time, the public was allowed to eat from new wheat. And as an offering in the temple, it was taken from the very first barley that ripened, which was sometimes a nationwide search party to find the barley that had ripened. That was brought in the temple. New wheat was brought in the temple only in Shavuot. So that moment of the Omer meant that you can now eat the new grain, and we start counting from the moment of the cutting of the Omer from that day. We count 49 days, 7 weeks, and then comes the holiday of Shavuot. It doesn't have a specific date as the other ones does. It's a consequence of the action.
But why count? What's the purpose of counting?
I call it the director's cut.
Oh, it's cute. But why count? Why should we count at all? What's the purpose of counting?
Count makes an association between one element and another. This count is a cumulative. In other words, it rises and it integrates everything as one piece. In fact, it's an argument in halacha whether each day is a separate mitzvah or whether all the days are one. One of the reasons why if you didn't make a blessing one day, then you don't make the blessing is because...
But that doesn't prevent people from counting. So
you
even
count
if they miss the blessing,
other, but maybe
you're still accomplishing something by counting.
You may not be accomplishing anything according to that opinion.
According to the second opinion.
Right, but it might be so integrative that it requires everything altogether.
Right, and it's very interesting because this is a mitzvah that we don't make a Shechianu on. We don't make the special blessing of the first time of performing of that mitzvah.
And one reason is because you might not complete it. It's because it's spread over so much time.
Over a lengthy period of time.
And Henny of blessed memory, my wife's aunt, only served cheesecake on Shavuot to those who completed the count.
That's good. But let's sidebar for a second, because I know you wanted to talk about the structure of the Jewish year before we started talking about the Omer itself. Maybe give a little bit of background to the structure of the Jewish year.
One point is that, contrary to the way I was raised in popular language, we don't have commemorative holidays. We are not commemorating the Exodus for Egypt. We are reliving it. We're in the same time period. We're at the same place in the cycle where that Exodus took place. Each year has that potential within that day. So maybe different historical events will reflect it, like the day of Tisha B'Av expressed itself in different destructions, so to speak. But the day this year, this day, has the same power as it did then, and we can access it through following the customs of the day, or in some cases even the commandments of the day. And the year has a progression. The year has a flow. We go from Purim to Pesach, from Pesach to Shavuos to Sukkot. We go from Shavuos to the 3 weeks. The day, which did not historically develop at one moment and is a cumulative result of history, as you're going to point out, I hope, our discussion about when the Bar Kochva events entered the holidays and affected this time period, it's a result of a long development. Some aspects are universal for every Jew on the planet. Some were stressed more by particular communities. For example, there's a holiday called Simchat Kohen. And there is no holiday called Simchas Kohen. The holiday called Simchat Kohen or Simchat Kohen is followed in some Oriental communities on the day after Yom Kippur.
I think there's a guy, Irving Cohen, that makes a special holiday in Brooklyn. Which he calls Simchas Cohen, but that's
right.
A different story.
But my neighbors in Katamon Tet said today, from French Morocco, said today is Simchat Kohen. And some of my neighbors, they asked them, they looked at me, and one of my neighbors said, what do you mean, is today Simchat Kohen? Like, where have you been? And they asked Rav Rudiman Zatzal, the Rashiv of Ner Yisrael. He hadn't heard about it. So there's some aspects which are stressed more. I didn't know Lag BaOmer was more than what it is till sometime later in Yeshiva. And here in Israel, Lag BaOmer is a major, major day of celebration. So some aspects are stressed more as opposed to universal. And this period in particular has nuances where some people ignore certain aspects, some people stress certain aspects, some people do more than stress. They celebrate or live or are immersed in certain aspects of this time. But the whole year is a cycle, and it's constantly repeating, and we go up and up and up and up on the individual level and on the
national
level.
Well, you know, our
level.
Teacher, Rabbi Matthias Weinberg, so he likes to point out that it's not a circle, it's more like a spiral. Because you may revisit the same moments in the calendar year, but hopefully you're building each year on a higher level and adding to your understanding, your awareness, your relationship with the year. That goes beyond just revisiting a particular nexus or a particular point in time.
Yes.
But I think your earlier point was very important, and that is one of the primary distinctions between a Jewish holiday and a secular holiday or an American holiday like the 4th of July. And we celebrate the 4th of July and people have a barbecue, and which is a beautiful thing, and they have a go to a fireworks celebration, and these are commemorative kinds of things where we remember the event of that day, hopefully, right, and try to connect on some level with that event. We're experiential, but it's not just an incorporation. We're asked this, particularly on Passover, but
the secular. Even the secular is, remember we're Americans, remember we didn't always have it this way, let's appreciate it, let's celebrate being who we
right.
are.
So the memory part is very, very important, especially in a cultural society where you're trying to build a connection with that cultural identity. We're going one step beyond that and saying, we want you to experience as if you went through this event yourself, which is a particularly Passover-oriented event, but it's not exclusive to that. When we bring the shofar and we blow the shofar, correct. But when we blow the shofar, we want that to make a change in you.
That's
we want that to change
today.
Your awareness.
It's not because once there was a judgment. There's a judgment today
right
and now.
Now. That's right. It's not
now.
Merely commemorative. Very nice. Okay. So we have a year that is meant to be, it's full body sport. You know, we become fully immersed, so to speak, in the activities of the day on a number of different levels. Both our intellects and our emotions are caught up, hopefully, in the process of that time period. At the same time, we're now in the period between Passover and the holiday of Shavuot. And the period itself is described in the Bible. Maybe tell the listeners a little bit about the period that we now find ourselves in terms of what was going on when the Jews left Egypt until they got to Mount Sinai. What was happening?
In terms of the biblical description, there is what you're describing now, which is the historical events on round one, so to speak. And then the next level are the commandments, which relate more to the agriculture, which are also in progression. So in terms of the historical events, almost the year of plagues, the way our rabbinical sources understand the way the plagues played out, it's almost a year's worth. And now we have a number of things coming together. On a Shabbat, we take a sheep or goat, which was the idol of Egypt, and we tied it to our beds. That
one
was
of the idols
of
Egypt, one of the gods of Egypt.
Yes. And on Thursday, we had a Passover offering, and we went out of Egypt. And 7 days later, we crossed the Red Sea. I just heard today from Rev Moshe Chaim Brandwein. He was quoting an ancient sefer that said, then they went for 3 days and they complained about the food. And so the Shabbat, the first Shabbat afterwards, was when the manna began to fall. And that's why there's a blessing of sustenance in the first Shabbat. And that's why in some communities they have a key challah, or they focus on sustenance
that's,
in the
I
year.
I think that's where the expression for that blessing comes from, is it's a manna of speaking.
Very nice, very nice. The people came through. We did not exactly act properly all during that time. We had a lot of complaints, and we were very difficult
well,
in
so
this
maybe,
time
maybe
period.
Let's clarify for the listeners. There's really two kinds of periods that typify the Exodus from Egypt. The first period is the period from the actual Exodus itself until the Jews are on Mount Sinai. Then there's going to be a period of close to 40 years following the Mount Sinai event that is a different period. It's a different kind of a historical period. It's less about the building, so to speak, of or the spiritual sophistication that is achieved from the Exodus itself until the Jewish people were ready to accept the Torah, and more about a transitionary period that's going to allow a new generation to enter into the land of Israel. So those are very, very distinct kinds of periods, right? The period that we're focused on right now is not the second one. It's the first one. The period of getting from the slave mentality and the entrenched, I don't want to say dirt, but impurity of what it meant to be immersed in the Egyptian culture and civilization, and preparing oneself for being ready to receive God's Torah.
Absolutely. I'm saying, but even within that time, it was not smooth sailing. There were hiccups. We caused problems, and we were not fully ready.
Correct.
And in the end, we did say Naseh v'nishma. We did say we will do...
Well, Naseh v'nishma, explain what that is, and why is that significant?
We spun and said, whatever you say, we're going to do, and then we'll learn about how it works afterwards, and we'll do it afterwards. And a visceral acceptance of God's will, with questions and degrees of separation coming only later. And that the moment of love and that moment of acceptance was really formative in our relationship. It's just that we can't pat ourselves on the back and say, okay, we left Egypt, and then we got ready, and Jethro came, and they came to accept the Torah, and everybody was happy every after. We were weak, and we dealt with a Amalek.
So maybe this is a good point to emphasize that the theme that underlies the entire Jewish year and our identity as the Jewish people more than anything else is the event of Yetziat Mitzrayim. It's not the entering into the land of Israel, even though that was important. It's not the receiving of the Torah. All of the calendar...
The touchstone.
Right? The thing... And I think what you said before is exactly right. In other words, the point of contact where God decides to intervene in the affairs of man on behalf of his firstborn son, out of that sense of love and care and the relationship that he built with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, right, is not dependent on the flaws that may be part and parcel of who we are as a nation into the future. That relationship is special, it's unique, and I will involve myself in the affairs of the world, myself personally, not through indirect means, right? And that is what is going to underlie everything else that follows.
It's a beautiful point. I'm just thinking that that this can also be setting the scene for our current situation, where as a result of different historical developments, we view this period as a struggle with flaws and a struggle for perfection. It wasn't a perfect time, even on round one, even in that first year. So it's set for it, and it's part of the understanding today, which we'll discuss it, I think, by itself, but it's part of the understanding today that there's an achievement of personal national identity on Passover. There's a reset button, no leavening, no development, everything simple and straight, a Seder, an order. You do it exactly like this.
Here's the program.
And now that you're programmed, now you run with it, and Kol Hamar Bahrezen Meshubach, you talk more about going out of Egypt, everybody on their level, that increases more. And then we, from there, the Sefer Todah, Leo Kitov, says, well, why didn't you start counting on the first day of Passover? Because the first day of Passover has to have its own identity. So much is going on, you can't confuse it. Okay, so you finish the first day. On the second day, which in Israel is a regular day, and even on the outside of Israel, it's not the same thing as the first day, it's only rabbinic. So on the second day, okay, now let's realize that we're starting a process now.
That's when it really
and
counts.
And we go, and that's when it really counts. And that is a... is tremendously stressed because even if labors are forbidden, since this is for an offering, we do it. And there's another aspect where it says, Mimacharat HaShabbat, after the Shabbat, it calls this Passover a Shabbat, which is a discussion by itself. Following the Sabbath, that's when you cut the Omer. There were breakaways like the Sadducees who and the Baitusins who said, we take the Bible literally. I was at Mount Gerizim twice this Passover. We take the Bible literally, and therefore they would work to make sure that the calendar came out that Passover was on the Sabbath, and then the count would start afterwards. And we go out of our way, especially in the time of the Second Temple, we go out of our way to make a public spectacle where even it's on the Sabbath, we cut down the grain, and we are going to start the Omer process because that is a public commandment which overrides the laws of the Sabbath. So it's very significant, this initiation. And I recall Rabbi Weinberg many years ago focusing on the fact that there's a human action which triggers it. And as we're counting now, and we remember that there was the bringing of the Omer, and some Sephardi communities in particular, they learn a chapter of the Mishnayot, the Menachot, they learn the Mishnah about the commandment, they read the verses, they have a whole prep before they hit it, so as much as possible, they feel they're out there in the field with the Kohen, and they're cutting it. But it's response to human action and our involvement.
So maybe spend a minute just explaining the agricultural component of the three prime holidays.
We are blessed now to be living in the natural environment and the weather environment and the seasonal environment of the Bible itself. I'm told, I remember to some degree myself, but I'm told by people who live in another hemisphere, it's so hard to talk about when everything is springtime, when it's winter, you know. That's, so at this moment, if the calendar has been properly structured and when necessary a second Adar was added, that the winter is over, everything is blooming, everything is budding. And I once had a Passover Jeep trip with Yehonatan Abramson of Jeep Tiki in Yavnel, and we were in Nachal Dishon, and he showed us, here's barley, and the kernel isn't there yet. Because of where it was, it ripens less quickly up in the hills where everything is moister than down in the valleys where the heat gets more and it ripens quicker.
You should know, I was in Neve Daniel at a friend of ours' house last Friday, and the almond tree outside the front door is in full foliage, you know, all the green leaves. It looks beautiful after the winter. I said, there's no blooms on it. She said, the last winter storm that we had last week, which we had a late winter storm and a freezing, destroyed all the buds and flowers on the, so there won't be any almonds on that tree this year because the late winter storm damaged the young buds.
I was in I talked to two different olive oil producers in the Shomron, and they each said that last winter storms was devastating. So one, for example, from last year's crop produced 250 liters as opposed to 1,200 liters. And the other one said, I have less than they usually do. So it's very sad.
So we appreciate the water, but the fact that there's a late winter storm really changes the nature of how much bounty there will be, how much fruit and produce and no, there will be in the coming
just
year.
Just like they protect oranges in Florida from frost, it could be that they will begin to make protective measures because this, quote, out of season, unquote, has happened a number of times. Now, the thunder and lightning storm that we had 3 days ago, a neighbor shook me in the morning. He said, I never saw lightning like this. Nady Charles just turned, I think, 92?
Three. I think that's what Facebook said.
That's what Facebook said. He said, in my whole life, I never heard, he was in bed, I never heard a storm like this. I was shaking, I woke up.
Yeah.
And said, okay. But in normative times, everything is now budding. So the barley ripens first, and therefore we bring the offering from the barley. Between Passover and Shavuot, the wheat is ripening, as the Book of Ruth discusses what happened at the time of the cutting of the time of the cutting of the barley, and what progressed at the time of the cutting of the wheat. And the wheat offering in the temple is the two loaves of bread made from the new wheat, the Shtei HaLechem, which is brought in Shavuot. So we're in that time. So on Shavuot is the time of the cutting of the harvest. You've cut the grain, and now it's going to lie out in the field and dry out by natural process. In Sukkot is Chag Asif. You are gathering in, and that's why it's called the time of joy, because you have the products of the year. You can now sit and relax. I know the storehouses are full. Unless you're in olives, in which case the olive picking season is the month afterwards. But we're already eating and picking from the summer's fruits now. We already have grapes in now, and grapes that will be picked for wine will be later in the year. But, so that's the cycle, the budding, the blooming. Tu B'Shvat plays a role. Also, has it budded, bloomed, has it gotten to one-third growth by Tu B'Shvat? Which year is it associated with? That's one marker. And then we come to Pesach, which is the spring and the kernels that have ripened, to the harvesting, and then to the gathering in.
Very nice. I think, again, just as a side point, what we also have is by being so connected to the commandments in the Bible that relate to agriculture, forces an awareness of the sensitivity that we have to bring to our dependency on the cycles of the season, on the rains, being sensitive to the need to maintain a healthy environment. And so this is a very green consciousness that we have that we don't necessarily have outside of Israel in the same way or to the same degree.
And the Chazal stress that the particular mitzvot are bring me these fruits so that you'll pray to me about the fruits and I will bring a blessing to your fruits. And each of the offerings is time for that thing. It was just this morning, somebody who lives alone has a problem with vision. He says, I don't have the seven relatives. I don't have a parents. I don't have a wife. I don't have children. I don't have siblings. He's all by himself. And he struggles and he challenges and he comes in to learn. He said, I haven't yet made the blessing that one makes in Nisan on the budding trees. Can I still do it?
It was hard to see this year.
And we found a date palm just outside where we were learning. There, it steps away. But because the sunlight was so bright on it, he couldn't see the buds, but the buds were there. And it's just reminded, many years ago, we used to go to Kibbutz Shluchot for Passover, and they're in the Beit Shan Valley. Date trees is one of their key industries. And we were given the tour by one of the date growers, and he explained that the pods open right before Pesach, and you have 48 hours to dust the male part of the tree, or you won't have...
Which fertilizes the trees so it'll bear fruit.
Or you won't have dates. Yes. And it happens right then. I was thinking, how did they stay awake for the Seder? And that explains the Mishnah that the rabbis were very upset with the date growers of Jericho who were working on the eve of Passover. But if they wouldn't have worked on the eve of Passover, they wouldn't have had a date crop. There wouldn't be any dates of Jericho. So it was this balance where it's recorded that, you know what I mean, like the rabbi said, you know, that's right, you know, they do this, they get yelled at, but that's the balance. They do it, but they have to be yelled at because we don't take it for granted
by
that you can just
itself.
Do it.
Yeah, very
but,
nice.
But that's, again, this timing of the budding of Passover.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, you know, we've kind of reviewed the biblical roots and underpinnings of the period. There's another aspect to the period that we mark as we count in our prayer books, in our Sidurim, during the course of this period, and that for those people who notice
what,
beyond...
Sorry, what is that? What's a prayer book?
What's a prayer book?
Yeah.
I don't know. What's a prayer book?
I don't know. I have a smartphone. I have an app. It changes at sunset and tells me the
days. It's a good point, but even my app tells me this information.
Yes.
But if you look at the end of each day, there's a verse there, and then there are two words that reflect the nature of that day. And according to some of the more esoteric parts of Jewish knowledge, according to the Kabbalistic approach to Jewish knowledge, right, this period is not just broken down into weeks and days, but is also structured to be able to understand the various attributes or godly attributes through which God relates to humanity. And though each one of those midot, each one of those attributes, is broken up further by its various components. Maybe talk a little bit about the qualities of the days.
Maimonides, in the laws of Deot, attitudes, behaviors, as you will, discusses the way of God which Abraham discovered. And the Baalei Kabbalah, the Kabbalists, and translate into more practical terms, down-to-earth terms by Rav Matthias Weinberg and by others, is that in this there are seven lower attributes of God that are expressed in the world, and that
just
we can
clarify lower attributes. They're not that they're low attributes.
I shall. And that we work to emulate them. Mahu rachum afata rachum. Just like He is compassionate, we become compassionate. So too, there were seven individuals who each expressed as an archetype these seven attributes. There are 10 attributes, 10 core attributes. There are three higher ones. And Chachma, Bina, and Daat, which is Chabad, wisdom, insight, and understanding, and knowledge, and those words mean nothing in this context. They are the Keter, they're the crown, they're the operating system behind. But what filters down to us is seven core attributes. And in each one of these weeks, one attribute is more active. In each one of these attributes is comprised of the seven core elements of the overall expression of God.
And maybe, what are those elements?
I shall. Okay. I'm thinking out loud. The Kabbalists take it down to even further that it has another power. Even each one is comprised of all elements. So, you have the element of chesed. Let's call it loving kindness, which doesn't do it justice. And Abraham is that archetype. And then you have din or gvura, judgment, and everything being in its place. And that is Isaac. Tiferet, splendor, beauty, the integration of the general and the specific, to see beauty in the grain of sand, to see the universe, it's Blake's words, which I've horribly misquoted at the moment, is Jacob. Then, it's a question of what the then is, but we'll go right now with the next one being Netzach, eternity, which is expressed by Moses, and then Hod, glory, the expression of the individual, the expression of the beauty, the expression of God, which
come together,
and
they're in
with
parallel.
Aaron, they are paired, and then comes Yesod, relationship, fundamental underpinnings, which is Joseph, Malchut, kingship, the emergent expression of the totality, which is expressed by David. In Kabbalistic terms, these are also laid out in terms of the body, the right hand, the left hand, the middle, and so on. They work together. Chesed itself is comprised of chesed, gvura, of all these elements. So day number one is chesed shebechesed, that aspect of chesed which is expressed in chesed. And then gvura, which is in chesed. Today, we are in the day of chesed, which is in that expressed in tiferet, because we're in level three, we're in the third midah, in the first day. And in some prayer books, you have a prayer that, may I repair everything which I did wrong and reach the full height of what today's element does. And those who can have insight to it know and explain and teach what there is to think about, to contemplate, to work on, and what type of actions will enhance that particular aspect. When we complete going through all seven attributes and each one of the seven attributes of the seven attributes, we have fixed, so to speak, our actions, our behavior, our souls, and then come to a level of perfection coming out of Egypt, so to speak, 49 levels of defilement, which the sages talk about, and have gone up 49 levels, and now on the 50th day, we come to a jubilee, and we come to Shavuot, to Pentecost and to accepting the Torah out of wholeness.
I have to say, I wish there was a simple way of explaining this concept, but you did a fantastic job.
Thank you.
It's very complicated, and it's easier to see it, and maybe we should post something on our website or on the Facebook page that illustrates what we're talking about to some degree that people would appreciate.
Right. When we say we, that means you.
I guess that's probably true, but all that notwithstanding.
Yes.
What this affords us, though, is the ability and an approach. It may not be the only approach, but it's an approach towards working on our character, working on our behavior, working on our relationships, both with man and God, within a very structured, focused fashion. And that allows us to enter in to the holiday of the receiving of the Torah, right, having done the work of preparation to be fit to receive such a wonderful gift.
Including repairing relationships.
I said, in between man and God and human beings, right.
But I'd like to stress it, because now, as we're jumping a little bit, but we have a later historical event of the breakdown of the relationship between the students of Rabbi Akiva, which was seen as a flaw in how, potentially, Torah would be transmitted to future generations. That generation had to go, and the focus there was they didn't honor each other. In an earlier aspect, I heard Rabbi Weinberg talk about, Nadav did not consult with Avihu. Avihu did not consult with Nadav.
Nadav and Avihu, who
are
they?
The two sons of Aaron, and the day of the consecration of the tabernacle, and the origins of the temple, which we didn't discuss, but also happens in Nisan and in this period, they didn't consult with their teachers. They didn't want to get married because nobody was good enough to have a relationship with them. They did something which was unasked for. And they didn't even consult with each other, because I have my way of viewing things. I'm not going to break it down except intercourse with change of molding, melding with anybody else. And that was the height of destruction. And so that, too, is something that we address in this time, and that's why
it's really the antithesis of the successful relationship of Moses and Aaron themselves.
Yes. And Vayichan Yisrael, that it says that in Israel camped, the sages and the commentaries point out, why are you saying it in the singular fashion? Because we achieved at that moment, we were one entity.
Heart, one
heart, one
mind,
one person,
one heart,
so to speak. As we sat there to receive the Torah, at least for a moment, it was there. And you and I, at this the grand old age where we can still play basketball on some level, right? But we've been through a number of traumatic moments of the people of Israel in modern times: the Six-Day War, the capture of Nachshon Waxman, various events of the war of this past summer, where we've seen outpourings.
Even before the war, when the three boys were kidnapped.
Yeah, divisions disappeared at least for 10 minutes, 10 days, 1 month, 4 months. And I want to say, I may be wrong, I want to say that the newscasters and various people have to sort of force themselves to say, okay, now Chozrim L'Shigra, we're going back to normal. We have to be normal now, and again start with petty clipping and arguing and snide remarks and sexual innuendos, because we can't really stay up high where we were as Yisrael on that level. It's very hard to maintain that. But we went up again.
That moment.
Yes.
Those periods of time when there's really a coming together and a focus in terms of who we are and what we represent and what we care about is palpable. Everybody recognizes it, regardless of their, you know, political or religious, you know, sensibilities. There's something that is Yisrael, that is
right.
The Jewish
and
people.
So that has happened again and again and again, unfortunately, through trauma. Everybody feels the pain of the boy who was run over deliberately by a car several days ago. There's millions of people who are caring about that one of us was hurt and killed because he was a person in Israel, and it turns out he's the nephew of my neighbors. And
but that's incidental.
It's
incidental that
people don't know him at all.
It doesn't matter who it is. He could be me.
That he could be,
or
he
is
me. Or
he
is
me.
Is
me.
It's part of my being here. Is that he took the hit from the team.
I don't mean in the sense of victimization, but in the sense that this is who we are.
Yeah.
This is what.
Yeah, and people far away.
That guy who's got you in his rifle sights or has a rock thrown at you couldn't care less. It's the fact that you are who you are and what you're part of that I'm fighting against. So that I guess brings us to the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva, the students of Rabbi Akiva.
I just want to mention I had very few tours this summer because of the war. People canceled.
Just pass them.
In fact, the Wall Street Journal interviewed me on that topic. But I had one or two tours, I think two, where people got on the plane because of it. Not at all religious. Not a shred. I was asked to give Sabbath tours. I explained I don't drive. Not a shred. We went to Otef Aza. We went with one
the
of
belt,
them.
The belt
we
around.
We went to the belt around and we met different
that were the
flower
front
grower.
These agricultural communities.
So we met a woman. She's a ceramist. She used to have a beautiful view.
Ceramicist.
And all of a sudden, a wall went up some years ago, and she's the front line facing an unfriendly Gaza. She used to have a beautiful view and relationship with Gaza. Like,
which
what
they didn't
happened?
Expect to ever be. And then after the communities were forcibly evicted in 2005, right? The expectation was this is now going to be a quiet area. This is going to be. We've now given Gaza to the Arabs, to the people,
including functional hothouses and everything else,
and so that should buy us peace in this area.
Right, we could go off. But what I was saying is, I met a woman who talked openly to my group about what she does on the Sabbath, which has nothing to do with Sabbath observance, and she refuses. I think she was saying on Yom Kippur she doesn't go to the synagogue. She does gardening, but she's making pieces of ceramics for Arab and Jewish children to build together into the wall and to hope for peace in all the different languages. She's doing what she can. And the tunnel, the tunnels that came up just a few minutes away from her house. Yesterday was reported in the news. It could be it's 2 days ago, but I caught up yesterday that all types of moving equipment, earth-moving equipment above and below ground is operating in Gaza. And that we, Prime Minister Netanyahu, referred to this in the summer that it was coming. We have some people who worked out an algorithm. I don't know why it has to do with algorithms, but it does. You know those jokes they said, I didn't use math today, it doesn't hurt me? Yes, you did. You just didn't feel where it was used. And I've found a way to detect tunnels being made and to be able to protect them.
New techniques are being employed.
New techniques are being deployed, also underwater, also above water. I saw three different things in the past day. How do they get to that? So I don't share with that woman an orientation of what I'm doing in Israel, so to speak, or how I live my life, or the blessing I just made on the cake, which I shouldn't have had for my diet, but it was Rosh Chodesh, and your wife's cakes are not to be ignored when they're sitting there. And but we share deeply. We are both in this with our lives, with our children. She's physically on the front line, and we're in the same story. My boys went into Gaza. We are together. The differences are relatively minor and can dissipate in a moment of clarity, of change, in any direction. It's very strong.
I'll remind you, I think you were at this meeting, but maybe I'm wrong, but it's many, many years ago. And we were asked to come to a meeting with Rabbi Noach Weinberg. And he said, if you have $1 million in your pocket...
I wasn't there.
You weren't at the meeting? If you have $1 million to spend on a program for that would be of benefit to the Jewish people, what would you spend $1 million on? So the people at the meeting, everybody came up with different ideas. I said, listen, everybody's focused on a particular thing that makes them different from all the other groups, and this one's addressing this need, and this one's addressing... I said, the one thing we don't have in the Jewish world is something that focuses on the fact that we have much more in common than we have that's different. A common denominator. And based on that, he went ahead and he set up an organization called Machane Meshutaf, Common Denominator, to focus. I don't know if it still exists even. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. I don't know. But
it did a lot of good, and it's time.
What you're saying is exactly right. In other words, and that's why in times of national stress, you see that we're capable of coming together.
Yeah.
So that's an important fundamental, and I think that transcends national borders also, although that is being tested today. You know, there's the sense of responsibility, and I think the Jews in Europe feel it much more than the Jews, let's say, in the United States. This is when we're under attack at a kosher supermarket on a Friday before the Sabbath. Right, we understand that we are all in the same pot.
That's such a difficult year to realize how many things happened over the past few months. It's astonishing. We were there in San Diego, where in San Diego State University they put out 548 graves on the lawn. That's what greeted everybody. I just saw yesterday camera put out the nine media lies that are of the past war that are stuck in everybody's head. I didn't have time to look them up, but it's frightening to watch. Okay, back. So, bring us back to our period.
So we're back in the period between Passover and Pentecost, between Pesach and Shavuot. And one of the things that I think people tend to make into the priority rather than into the secondary aspect of this period is the fact that it's also become a period of mourning. And this directly relates to the Bar Kokhba rebellion. And in many ways, this period is typified by, at least in terms of the Babylonian Talmud's description of the event in the Tractate of Yevamot, right? The relationship of the students of Rabbi Akiva to each other. And so in our version of the Talmud, right, the Talmud discusses how there were either 12,000 or 12,000 pairs or 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva, and that they all died between the period of Passover and Shavuot, and that by itself requires some level of explanation because we don't grieve during the entire period. We're focused on, in particular, 33 days. And the way they treated each other is that they don't seem to have accorded each other the honor that was due to them. What that means specifically, nobody details. But the way the Talmud discusses it is that they weren't noheg kavod ze baze. They didn't treat each other with enough respect. Now, what's interesting...
Just the point that we maybe missed in round one, that another aspect of Shavuot is that it's the Atzeret. It's really the climax of Passover.
Of the whole
and it's
period.
It's dealt with as one period of the counting. To the point that Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman Nachmanides says, deal with the days in between Passover and Shavuot as Chol HaMoed, so to speak, as intermediate days. You're in one flow, which should be such a happy time. Sukkot has the same thing. It has Shmini Atzeret to climax it as an eighth day, and theoretically,
both are called Atzeret.
Midrashim, it would have come in the middle of the winter, but instead of making us come in the middle of the winter, God said, I got a discount for you on the same trip. You can get two of them. But in other words, there needs to be a process where the major regel, the major festive holiday, initiates a process that takes time, and then there's a climaxing moment, which is called Atzeret, or full stop, so to speak. So we're in that time. We're in that bracket also.
Right. So to bring us back to the students of Rabbi Akiva, the Talmud says that their punishment, that what happened was they died during some kind of plague during this period called Askara. It's not exactly clear what this disease is, but it's some kind of choking disease, some kind of problem with breathing or respiration. Right. And that during this period, during the days, the students passed away, but that either as a stop somewhere in between on Lag BaOmer, there was either a pause in their deaths, or right that and that either from the period beginning with the end of Passover until Lag BaOmer was the period, or from Rosh Chodesh Iyar, which is today here. It's Rosh Chodesh Iyar for 2 days here, right? But we are either in the last day of Nisan, and tonight will be the first day of the new month, but both days are called Rosh Chodesh, the beginning.
Right, but in terms of this, the count starts from Iyar.
From the beginning of Iyar, and then goes till Shavuot, to the holiday itself.
I received a ruling today, because of a particular situation I'm in, that I should keep the days of mourning in the latter set, and I should get a shave today, which I don't. I start because I start from Shavuot, but I'm going to hit reset today, and I have to, before sundown,
start
shave.
Again.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
All the first days won't count. Right? I'm going to start again for a particular reason, and so I'm following this year the custom of
this is a very unusual,
starting Rosh Chodesh
Iyar. Very unusual custom in that, right, it's not clear when they died. In other words, it's during this period. It's either the first 33 days, essentially, or in the 33 days starting from Rosh Chodesh until the holiday of Shavuot.
And my grandfather, my mother's father's custom was, in his village, you kept the entire period and you shaved on the eve of Shavuot. Right? They didn't even. It wasn't just 33 days of. They kept the whole time.
Which many of the halachic authorities suggest not doing, which is not to keep that entire period as a period of mourning.
Tough Ukrainians laugh at such things.
Yes. But what's interesting is that Rabbi Shrira Gaon, one of the Gaonim, one of the early rabbinical leaders.
Post-Talmudic.
Post-Talmudic, but before the what we would consider to be the modern period. So in his version of the Talmud Bavli, this event is described very differently. He does not mention the issue of the students treating each other with a lack of respect, and he doesn't mention this Askara disease, but he does use the word Shamda, which is Shmad, which means a destruction. And one of the suggestions by scholars is that during this period there was a campaign from Hadrian that targeted the students of Rabbi Akiva, or that because the students of Rabbi Akiva were followers of Bar Kochva, and they met their demise. Now, I believe that Shmad doesn't indicate warfare. I don't believe that they were killed in battle. I don't believe that they were killed in war. But I believe, just like we have the 10 martyrs that were targeted and taken for execution by the Roman authorities over a long period of time, right, the students of Rabbi Akiva, I believe, were targeted during this period and taken and literally executed on the spot when they were found. So, and the word Shmad is what we often use to describe also the Holocaust. And so this is a campaign that targets, and there have been a number of these kinds of targeted destructions that have occurred in Jewish history. This doesn't indicate warfare. This seems to indicate a campaign to eliminate these people. In which case...
Or their ideology, even if the people stay
like
the Russians.
But that's part of it. That was the reason. It was because of the ideology, I would assume. And that puts a very different kind of a spin. The question is, right, when did that change in the versions of the Babylonian Talmud occur, and why, and by whom? We know that the Babylonian Talmud was redacted and edited in various periods, in particular by the Catholic Church, that sought to remove things that were inflammatory or seen in some ways being disparaging.
Or by Jews who didn't want to have the Talmud burned, or Jews burned by the Catholic Church in its classic form because of things that the Talmud said.
Correct. So what we have, though, is on top of the positive nature of this period, which is, in the Bible's view, extremely positive and productive and growth-oriented, a layer of mourning that sits on top of that period, and that during the course of this period, whichever reason you ascribe to the death of the students of Rabbi Akiva, right, it still represents a tremendous loss to the future of the Jewish people at that time and for all history, essentially. You're talking about the leading scholars of their time. And how that could have impacted the future growth and development of the Jewish people is beyond our ability to measure. But what's clear, though, is that within that period of mourning, a number of days in more contemporary times have appeared which seem to be reversing the mourning nature. What are those days, Barnea?
Lag BaOmer and the 33rd of the Omer, which is Hod Shebehod, call it Glory of Glory, which is the day of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's passing.
And some say his birthday as well.
Okay. That's why bonfires are associated. All of the different elements come together and create a great light. And it's a time of brightness. It's a bright spot. The 14th day of Iyar is Pesach Sheni, second Passover. A person who missed the opportunity to share in the national commandment of the Passover offering was able to bring it. And it was originally a response to people who, either because of the death and the tragedy, they handled the people who were dead now, or they were carrying Yosef graves. The Talmud goes through a few different options, or who these people were who said, Lama nigara, why should we lose out? So there's a rectification here. Rav Ruderman Zatzal said that this was a mitzvah not given on Mount Sinai in response again to the people, but it's a resurrection, so to speak. There was a loss and a new addition is there.
My Sephardic neighbors have been pointing out for the last couple of days that Iyar stands for Ani Hashem Rofecha. I am your God who heals you.
So that aspect is there also. And Sephardic Jews in Tiberias and Meron and elsewhere used to go to graves with Torah scrolls. It used to be a very special day. It had the role which perhaps Lag BaOmer has now. In more modern times, the 3 days before Shavuot are the 3 days where we relate to the 3 days of preparation for getting the Torah, and also those are happier days.
When we were camped around the mountain.
When we were camped around the mountain. Right. We have two Rosh Chodeshes during that time. Rosh Chodesh is a happier time. In modern times, the day in which we were able to come back to Jerusalem, and I'm not going to say that, and the Temple Mount was in our hands, because that is now, with today's shadows, not so clear. But the moment where we're able to come back to Jerusalem and to holy places is universally recognized.
During the Six Day
right,
War.
Universally recognized as a special moment. And there is a concept of a personal or a national or a community Purim, where there's a Frankfurt Purim. There's about 100 of them.
Amsterdam, different cities.
We're saved from destruction.
Exactly.
Somebody who lived in Jerusalem, the shells were falling on Jaffa Road and killed people. Somebody who lives in Jerusalem, was a Jerusalem resident on the day that the enemy forces were pushed back and their lives were no longer threatened. It's incumbent upon them in this sense to celebrate. But I've told this story on landmines before. I was a 10-year-old in fourth grade at Hill Academy of Pittsburgh, and over the loudspeaker, the word saying, "We got Jerusalem." The class stopped. We all ran to the library where there was a little black and white TV on top of a bookcase, and there's a newscaster speaking with a picture of Israel and the star says Jerusalem behind it. And we all understood that something special had happened, although we couldn't translate it. So that ripple effect changed many people's lives and changed the image of the downtrodden Jew to a degree. It helped Jews throughout the world connect to each other. And my father didn't promote the fact that he was an Israeli, but during the Six-Day War, we went door to door raising money for the Israel Emergency Campaign. And he had to, because this is what he could do for, you know, his family there and his people there. And it's very interesting for me to watch as a child him interacting with Gentile neighbors and explaining. All of a sudden he was the representative of Israel on the spot on this particular street of Squirrel Hill in Pittsburgh. So something happened on Jerusalem Day. There are people that say hallel. There are people that have a festive meal. There are people who at least give
wear
credence.
Wear their holiday clothing.
There are people who wear holiday clothing. Right. There's a range of reactions across the gamut. From the most fun things you can discuss, especially in Israel, is what is called Israel Independence Day, where there are people who halachically shave and make a holiday and say hallel with a blessing at night and in the day. And Rabbi Weinberg said a beautiful thing years ago in your house. I don't know if you remember. He said that in the book of Ezra, you see that when the second temple was built, everybody was crying. The old people were crying, and the young people were crying. The old people were crying because they said, this you call a temple.
They remembered the first temple.
Right, with the glory, with the... And the young people said, look, after everything, wow, we're back, we have the temple. So he said, the important thing is not to ignore it. There was a pekidah. Something happened. The fact that the people called Yisrael are now walking around on the land of Israel, calling it Yisrael, and action there. Something happened right now. You could be against it and call it a travesty. You could be for it and call it a miracle. But don't ignore it like a regular Wednesday. Something happened. Respond to it. But it's not a regular day.
Yeah, the vast majority of the citizens of the state of Israel recognize that this is a day that should be celebrated. So we're at the end of our time for today's session on Sfirat HaOmer, and we hope to be back next month with a new show that we will announce hopefully in the week or so ahead of the show. But I want to thank you, Barnea, for making the effort to come out to Efrat and sit here in the studio and to share your wisdom and your insight into this period.
I feel the schmaltz coming through the mic.
Really?
Yes.
Well,
I'm fleshig. It's okay.
It seems to agree with you.
Yes, so, but you know I'm doing my master's on the uses of animal fat and fowl fat.
So there you go. So you should be well acquainted with the schmaltz.
Thank you for chewing the fat with me.
So this is David Wilner.
And this is Barnea Levi-Selivan.
Thanks for joining us today on Landmines.